Hello, and welcome to Learning English Weekend, the Sunday edition. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. It's April 17th, 2016. The Cambodian Civil War ended on this day in 1975. The Khmer Rouge captured the capital, Phnom Penh, forcing Cambodian government forces to surrender. It was the beginning of 4 years of mass killings, executions, starvation, and disease. It would come to be known as the Killing Fields. Now, here's what's ahead on today's program. In our weekly education report, Bruce Alpert will take us into some of the top high schools in America. Why do so many of them have such a large percentage of Asian American students? He'll tell you why. Then Anna Mateo will be with us, as she is every Sunday, with Words and Their Stories. This week, she tells us about expressions using the word legs. Listen to her report, and you'll get a leg up in life. And as we always do on the Sunday edition of Learning English Weekend, we will present The Making of a Nation. This week in our series, we take you back to 1919, 7 months after the end of World War I, when a treaty was finally signed, officially ending what came to be known as the War to End All Wars. Sadly, it was not. So, you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the voice of America. The four public high schools recently named as the best in the United States have much in common. They have high academic requirements, and they offer challenging courses. And they all have a large percentage of Asian American students. Education reporter Bruce Alpert is here to tell us more.
The top schools were chosen by the Niche.com website. Niche.com says it examined nearly 24,000 U.S. public high schools. It rated the schools based on quality of their education programs and teachers, as well as student and parent comments. The top four schools are Stuyvesant High School in New York City, High Technology High School in New Jersey, Staten Island Technical High School in New York City, and Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Technology in Virginia. The fifth best high school is Adlai E. Stevenson High School in Illinois, according to Niche.com. Stevenson is the only school among the top five that does not limit admissions. The school is open to all students in its community near Chicago. Enrollment of Asian Americans at the top high schools continues to grow. At Stuyvesant, 73% of students are Asian Americans. The rate is 63% at Thomas Jefferson, 52% at High Technology, 41% at Staten Island Technical, and 21% at Stevenson. At the top four schools, officials say there is only one reason for so many students being Asian American. They say the Asian American students are getting much better test scores. At Stuyvesant, Staten Island Technical, and High Technology, students are chosen based on how they do in mathematics and verbal admission tests. At Jefferson, students are asked to take a test and write a paper. Only a small percentage of the boys and girls get accepted. At Stuyvesant, 28,000 students apply for 935 openings. Alicia Ngo teaches at California State University in Fullerton. She talked about the success of Asian American students with VOA. If Asian American parents emphasize education, it has more to do with their perception that education can help them overcome existing barriers in the labor market, she said. The children who get into these top schools have many advantages. For example, classes at Stuyvesant are similar to those of a small college, according to insideschools.org. The website reports on New York City's public schools. Going to school with so many gifted students can push teenagers to do their best, but it can also put students under a lot of pressure to keep up. Stuyvesant is a hard place for a B student, wrote Inside Schools. A is the top grade at many schools. F is the lowest. Harvey Blum is a guidance counselor at Stuyvesant. He says the school works directly with students to help them deal with pressure. Sometimes, he says, school officials have to ask parents not to put too much pressure on their children. I tell them that if their child gets a 92 in a test, that is very good, and they should not criticize. Blum said, they should offer praise. 92 is a very good grade. Elise Hauptman has three children at Stevenson High School in Illinois, the number 5 rated public high school, according to niche.com. What she likes about Stevenson is that the school's counselors and teachers work hard to serve all students, not just those with the best grades. It is not just the top students or those facing the most challenges, Hauptman tells VOA. They don't want students in the middle to get lost. The quality education offered at Stevenson makes Hauptman question why some parents choose to spend a lot of money to send children to private schools. I'm Bruce Alpert.
Thanks, Bruce. Now, if it's Sunday, it's time for Ana Mateo and Words and Their Stories, one of our most popular programs. This week, she tells us about expressions using the word legs.
From VOA Learning English, it's time again for Words and Their Stories. Legs. They are the base of the body. They provide support and balance. And, of course, we use them to walk. Besides being a part of the body, leg also means a part of a journey or trip. For example, on the first leg of a trip, you might feel fresh and ready to go. But by the last leg, you might be tired and ready for sleep. Legs have walked themselves right into many English expressions. A useful expression using the word legs is to simply have them. If something has legs, it means people have interest in it. This expression often describes a story, issue, or scandal. If you are involved in a scandal that has legs, you will hear about it for a long time, which is unfortunate. On the other hand, you can also say that something does not have legs, meaning no one is interested. This expression is commonly heard in newsrooms and politics. Now I will demonstrate the power of a preposition. If I add up, to the expression has legs, you have a whole new expression with a whole new meaning. To have a leg up means that you are ahead of others in some competition. For example, if you are studying rocket science in college and your mother is a rocket scientist, you have a leg up on other students. Your mother can help you understand difficult concepts. You would have another leg up if your father owned the local rocket factory. Having a leg up is much better than not having a leg to stand on. This expression means that a person has no proof or evidence to support their actions or opinions. This expression is not new. Someone used it for the first time over 500 years ago. To not have a leg to stand on is often used in discussions about legal actions or court trials. If someone threatens legal action against you, but they do not have evidence to prove guilt, you could say, "Go ahead, take me to court. You don't have a leg to stand on." Keep in mind when using this idiom that it is only used in the negative form. So don't drop the knot. Now let's move our legs to the sea. Imagine you are on a boat that is rocking back and forth in rough ocean waters. You are unable to walk steadily, and you feel a little sick. This is because you haven't found your sea legs. Sea legs are the ability to move about and not feel sick while traveling on a boat or ship. If you are a pirate and you don't have a good pair of sea legs, your career may not progress as you would hope. Arr, matey! Now, the meaning of legwork is just as it sounds, the physical part of any task. For example, a political campaign involves planning and organization, but it also requires a lot of legwork. A candidate needs to talk to as many voters as possible. This means knocking on doors, standing at metro stations, and going to community meetings. So if someone tells you that running a political campaign is easy office work, they are pulling your leg. To pull someone's leg is to tell a lie, but in a friendly way. You can tell someone to not pull your leg. Or you can ask them if they are, as in this example.
I just won 2 free tickets to the big rock concert tonight and a free dinner on a nighttime boat cruise. Do you want to join me?
Are you pulling my leg? That sounds too good to be true.
It's true. I'll pick you up at 6 o'clock.
Some language experts say this expression may have come from a group in England many years ago called the Trippers Up. They were criminals who robbed people by pulling their legs out from under them. Besides pulling a leg, you can also tell someone to shake a leg. This means to hurry. You often hear parents telling children to shake a leg when they are getting ready for school in the morning, or perhaps not getting ready. Saying break a leg to someone performing on stage is the same as saying good luck. In the theater, saying good luck is actually considered to be bad luck. Saying break a leg is a tradition for actors and musicians, but not for dancers. Telling a dancer to break a leg would just be mean. Lastly, we come to last legs. If you find yourself on your last legs, you had better sit down for a while and rest. Being on your last legs can mean that you are so tired you cannot continue. And the personal pronoun here can change. She can be on her last legs, and he can be on his last legs. However, this expression does not have to be used just for a person. If something you own is old and not working, you can say it is on its last legs. For example, I have owned my car for 15 years, and it is on its last legs. Everything is breaking. A company that is losing money and soon to be out of business can be said to be on its last legs. But Words in Their Stories is not on its last legs. This show has been going strong for several decades. So please listen, like, share, and comment to make sure this show has legs to stand on in the years to come. I'm Anna Mateo.
Thanks, Anna. I really feel now like I've got a leg to stand on. Now, as we do every Sunday, we present The Making of a Nation. In 1918, on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, a truce took effect between the Allies and Germany. But it would be 7 months until a treaty was signed, officially ending what was known as the Great War and the War to End All Wars. This week in our series, Shirley Griffith and Larry West continue the story of the peace conference that followed World War I.
American President Woodrow Wilson was one of the chief negotiators at the conference in Paris. Throughout the early months of 1919, he struggled hard for a treaty that would result in peace with justice for all sides. Wilson demanded a treaty that provided for a new international organization. He called it the League of Nations. To Wilson, the League was more important than any other part of the treaty. Not all Americans shared Wilson's opinion. Many feared the League would take away the power of the American government to declare war and make treaties. They also agreed with the leaders of the other Allied nations. Establishing the League was less important than punishing the defeated enemy.
The other major Allied leaders at the peace conference were Prime Minister David Lloyd George of Britain, Premier Georges Clemenceau of France, and Premier Vittorio Otto of Italy. Lloyd George, Clemenceau, and Otto understood how much Wilson wanted the League of Nations. They used this knowledge to win Wilson's approval for other parts of the peace treaty. Wilson soon learned that to get the League, he had to compromise on many issues. For example, he had to accept British and French demands to make Germany pay all war damages. The payments added up to more than $300,000 million. Wilson also had to accept the Allied takeover of Germany's colonies.
Some of Wilson's compromises violated his belief in self-determination. This was the right of all people to decide for themselves who would govern them. One compromise, for example, gave to Japan Germany's colonial rights in the Shantung area of China. China protested the decision. It asked that control of Shantung be returned to the Chinese government. But President Wilson needed Japan's support for the League of Nations. so he accepted Japan's demand for control of Shantung. There were other violations of the policy of self-determination. These affected the people and land along the borders of several European nations. For example, 3 million Germans were made citizens of the new nation of Czechoslovakia. Millions of other Germans were forced into the newly formed nation of Poland. And Italy received territory that had belonged to Austria.
Today, most history experts agree Woodrow Wilson was correct in opposing these decisions. They say Germany's loss of territory and citizens caused deep bitterness, and the bitterness helped lead to the rise of fascist dictator Adolf Hitler in the 1930s. In East Asia, Japanese control over parts of China created serious tensions. Both decisions helped plant the seeds for the bloody harvest of World War II 20 years later. But Allied leaders at the Paris Peace Conference were not looking far into the future. As one person said at the time, they divided Europe like people cutting up a tasty pie.
After months of negotiations, the peace treaty was completed. The Allies gave it to a German delegation on May 7, 1919. The head of the delegation objected immediately. He said the treaty was unfair. He urged his government not to sign it. At first, Germany did not sign. The leader of the government refused and resigned in protest. But a new government was formed, and its leader signed the document at a ceremony at the palace in Versailles outside Paris. Finally, World War I was officially over.
President Woodrow Wilson returned to the United States after the treaty signing ceremony. He was not completely satisfied with the treaty, yet he believed it was still valuable because it established the League of Nations. Wilson's battle for the League was only half over when the treaty was signed in Europe. He had to win approval from the United States Senate. That half of the battle would not be easy.
Part of the problem was political. Wilson was a member of the Democratic Party. The Senate was controlled by the Republican Party. Also, Wilson had refused to name any important Republicans to his negotiating team at the peace conference. Part of the problem was personal. A number of senators disliked Wilson. One was Republican Senator Henry Cabot Lodge. Lodge was the powerful chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He told a friend he never expected to hate anyone as much as he hated Wilson.
Wilson spoke before the Senate just 2 days after he returned from Europe. He urged it to approve the peace treaty. Wilson said, "The united power of free nations must put a stop to aggression, and the world must be given peace. Shall we and any other free people refuse to accept this great duty? Dare we reject it and break the heart of the world? We cannot turn back. America shall show the way. The light streams upon the path ahead and nowhere else.
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee began hearings on the treaty. It heard a number of people who opposed the League of Nations. They said the League would destroy the freedom and independence of the United States. The committee completed its hearings and prepared a report for the full Senate. The report said the United States should reject the treaty unless changes were made. The committee proposed almost 40 changes.
The committee's report was a blow to President Wilson, both politically and personally. He had worked extremely hard to win Europe's support for the idea of a League of Nations. Great crowds in Paris had cheered him and his idea. Now, the Senate of his own country was about to reject it. Wilson decided he must take his case out of the hands of the people's representatives. He would take the case directly to the people themselves. He would build public support for the treaty. If enough citizens supported it, he believed, the Senate could not reject it.
President Wilson planned a speaking trip all across the country. His family and his doctor urged him not to go. They said he was still weak from a recent sickness. But Wilson refused the advice. He said the treaty was more important to him than his own life. The president left Washington in early September. He traveled in a special train. In city after city, he made speeches and rode in parades. He shook thousands of hands. At times, he suffered from a painful headache. But there was no time to rest.
Everywhere Wilson stopped, he urged the people to support the League of Nations. It was, he said, the only hope for peace. In Boulder, Colorado, 10,000 people waited to hear him. By then, Wilson was extremely weak. He had to be helped up the steps of the building where he was to speak. He made the speech. He said he was working to honor the men who had died in the war. He said he was working for the children of the world.
Wilson put all his heart and energy into his speeches. And just as his family and doctor had warned, the pressure was too great. While in Wichita, Kansas, the pain in his head became terrible. He could not speak clearly. His face seemed frozen. A blood vessel had broken in his brain. Wilson had suffered a stroke. The president was forced to return to Washington. His condition got worse every day, and soon he was unable to move. Woodrow Wilson would spend the rest of his presidency as a terribly sick man. He continued to hold on to his dreams of a League of Nations, but his dreams now filled a broken body. We will tell that story next week on The Making of a Nation. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz reporting from Washington. Jonathan Evans will be here tomorrow at this same time to help you learn everyday American English with As It Is Monday, the weekday Learning English broadcast, webcast, and podcast from the Voice of America.